Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this, the ninth in our summer series of lectures sponsored by the Pine Tree Foundation of New York. We're very grateful to the foundation, and we're grateful too to the Harrison Institute and to the Special Collections Library, the Albert and Shirley Small Special Collections Library here, for their gracious hospitality. I'd like to begin with a shameless commercial message. Tomorrow morning, if you are able, if things go according to schedule, you should endeavor to purchase the New York Times. It will appear, it appears now anyway, if the publishing schedule isn't supplanted by the resurrection of Bob Hope or some such event, that the front page of the arts section will have a feature on Rare Book School. I thought you should know, because none of your relatives understands at all what you are doing here. And this might help explain in some small measure. Tonight is cause for celebration in a much more immediate and, dare I say, greater way. For tonight, Matthew Carter will deliver the Saul M. and Mary Ann O'Brien Malkin Lecture in Bibliography. The Malkin Lecture is the highest honor that we can accord any individual who works in the bibliographical arts. It's named for the two founding editors of A.B. Bookman's Weekly, Saul and Marianne Malkin. And the A.B. Bookman's Weekly from 1948 to 1999 was among the most important journals in the antiquarian bookselling world. It covered collecting and research librarianship, as well as used and rare bookselling. And the journal was consistently full of trade news of interest to dealers and collectors and librarians. In 1984, Mary Ann Malkin began to support an annual lecture in honor of her husband, Saul, in recognition of his contributions to the antiquarian book trade. Our very own Michael Winship, sitting here in the front row, gave the first Saul M. Malkin Lecture in Bibliography at Columbia University way back in December 1985. After Saul Malkin died in 1986, just a few months after Winship had delivered the inaugural lecture, Mary Ann herself decided that she would continue to support Rare Book School, and she did so vigorously, both at Columbia and then at the University of Virginia. In the late 1990s, she allowed Rare Book School founding director Terry Bellinger, sitting here in the second row, to change the name of the lecture to the Saul M. and Mary Ann O'Brien Malkin Lecture in Bibliography. And until her death in 2005, she came down from New York City to attend most of the Malkin Lectures. And when she died, she left the school a significant portion of her estate. She was truly a friend of Rare Book School. Malkin lecturers over the years have included such notables as Greer Allen, Nicholas Barker, Bill Barlow, Bob Darnton, Miriam Foote, Christopher DeHamel, Lucian Goldschmidt, Jim Green, Selby Kiefer, Catherine Keyes Lee, Paul Needham, Bill Reese, Ken Rendell, Bernard Rosenthal, Tom Tansel, and Marjorie Wynn. And the list goes on and on. It seems strange that I should present to you Matthew Carter, because you have seen Matthew Carter all your life. All your life you have been looking at Carter, or at least you've been looking into something of Carter's mind. If you've ever used an Apple computer, if you've ever used a product by Microsoft, there are a few in the room who have actually used a Bloomberg terminal. All of these bear the mark of Matthew Carter's designs. If you've ever been to Heathrow Airport, if you've ever opened a copy of Sports Illustrated, if you've ever used a phone book that was published under the aegis of AT&T, you have seen Matthew Carter's designs. He is responsible for more than 60 typeface families and more than 250 individual typefaces. 7 of these are in the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art, MoMA, in New York. The 7 are Bell Centennial, to which I just adverted for the phone book, Big Caslon, ITC Galliard, Mantinea, Miller, which is the Rare Book School primary typeface, Walker, and Verdana. And one could go on, but let's let the man speak himself, albeit in just a minute. I am required by the Commonwealth of Virginia at this juncture in the proceedings to introduce a Thomas Jefferson anecdote. So the Jefferson anecdote and then the man himself. When Archibald Binney and James Rowlandson, immigrants from Scotland who established one of the first type foundries in the United States when they set up their shop in Philadelphia, asked the former president, Thomas Jefferson, for his help in obtaining antinomy, which, as you know, is used in type founding, because their existing supply was interrupted by an international trade dispute, Jefferson help them find a new source in France. And in later years, he expressed admiration for the types of Binney and Rowlandson, which by the 1920s had become the most commonly used types in the United States. So some years later, Rowlandson wrote again to Jefferson, sending him a specimen of the company's latest printing types, saying, "Don't you think they're good, sir? Don't you think we are making progress?" And this is TJ's reply. "Although increasing debility warns me that it cannot be long before the transactions of the world will close upon me, yet I feel ardent wishes for the continued progress of science and the arts and the consequent advancement of the happiness of man. When I look back to Bell's edition of Blackstone, about 1773, and compare his with your types, and by the progress of the last half century, estimate that progress in the centuries to come, I am cheered with the prospects of improvement in the human condition, which, although not infinite, are certainly indefinite." Had he known about the visionary work of Matthew Carter, TJ would surely have been proud. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to introduce him to you.
I'm so glad you told that anecdote because it sort of comes into my talk in a few minutes. So the talk is about revivals, some typefaces that I have derived from historical models. It's a very personal view, I think. I don't necessarily advocate this historical approach to designing type. In my own case, I suppose the backward look at history was rather hard to avoid. My father, Harry Carter, was a historian of type. Within a year of leaving school, this was in 1955, I'd spent time working in the type foundry of Enschede's in the Netherlands. I'd been at the Plant and Mauritius Museum in Antwerp and at the University Press at Oxford, three of the most important sanctuaries of typographic history, each with astonishing collections of ancient material. I was, as the French say, raised in the harem. This very intimate contact I was allowed with the historical treasures in those places, you know, I was impressionable age, 18 or something or other, influenced me very much, and I still feel it. But I'm not a nostalgist, nor an embalmer. I don't wish that all our typography looked like the typography of the 15th century or the 16th or the 17th, whatever. I'm someone living very much in the present, but given to an occasional backward look. And it's only really a minority of the faces I've designed that have been based on historical precedents, but they've been among my favourite projects, I think. The first one to talk about she said, tap the screen anywhere. Someone at the back is going to help me with this. Well done, thank you. I'm going to be more careful this time. Should we turn on the projector? I could wing this, but talk among yourselves. I'll be back with you in a minute. It says projector warming. I think that's a good sign.
Thank you. No.
Hey, okay. Up there, the panel, you know, there's source, and it says no source. Do you know what is the source? Where are the slides coming from? They're coming from this computer? Okay. Okay. So once it boosts, then we should be able to pick it as the source. That sounds good. Sounds like a plan. The worst part is the long waits.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is my privilege to introduce to you today Matthew Carter. But in a sense, it's strange that I should be introducing him to you before you have seen him all your life. Have you seen the film Groundhog Day? I neglected to mention, which is why we had a major power shutdown, that even the logo for Private Eye, the journal of record for satire in the UK, is in fact a Matthew Carter production. I didn't bring Sports Illustrated. I am told that the whole system has shut down and it will be about 4 minutes. It'll be about 4 minutes before we can power up fully again. So relax, it's all going to happen, and as the man himself said, talk among yourselves.
This is Ben. I think they have control over the floor there, too.
That did use to bring the screen up on the screen.
Yeah, so the projector's over there, and we've been seeing a lot of light coming from over there for a long time. But this is good.
It should be
progress.
Yeah. I don't know why it's not working, but this is everything it should be.
So you did this, I guess, already, right?
Yeah.
The projector says it's on and ready.
Right.
It's this.
That's just the volume.
Okay. It couldn't possibly be a laptop, could it? That should be those ones, right? Yeah, that's right.
This happened last time also, and I literally was like, okay, we need to make sure this works 10 minutes ago, and it worked just fine. And so I don't know what the problem is. The projector's on and ready. It should be fine.
Yeah, and the one thing I know is not to turn off a projector that thinks it's on. It's being blanked.
Right. When it's not on, so I need it up. So
can we try switching to laptop?
We need a laptop here.
I have a laptop.
Yeah, we can use that.
Okay, just for diagnostic?
Yeah.
Alright.
I'm so sorry.
That's right.
I don't know why this is happening. It happened last
Works time. So beautifully. Oh, did it? What did you do to fix it?
All we did was, the problem was that I had told them that if they woke it up, it would wake up, and it did, but that doesn't seem to be the problem for them. Yeah, everything's completely correct. I don't know what's going on. Do you have your flash drive for
now? Yes.
This is more of a diagnostic at this point.
But
over to the left side, please. You have to tell this scene to... yeah, I can display a PDF. So hang on, I'm going to have to do something. Oh, that's nice.
I am very sorry indeed. Were you running this on a Mac or a PC? We're running it off there.
We're running it off the system here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Agreed.
And it worked beautifully until 10 minutes
course.
Ago.
Yeah. Of course. And then I apologize. What's happened is they've just installed 3 weeks ago a brand new system.
Yeah.
And we said, now there's no bugs, right? And they said, no. We've got it all down. We figured it all out. And now you are the victim of
shakedown brews.
Exactly. Well, but the point is, we, you know, we have not had this kind of trouble before. We did have somebody, we had somebody from the booth put up the screen the way you did about 3 weeks ago, but that was because she just reached out and hit the wrong button. I apologize. Fortunately, you are not unused to public speaking.
No,
it's okay.
I'm happy, but
in that sense,
sooner or later we're going to get restless.
No, it's true. Terry has said that he'd be very happy to tell a Malcolm story if we need one. So, and we could do that too. Oh, it's completely shut down, so it looks like we're going to go to this.
Wow.
Okay.
All right.
Mr. Carter,
do you have a USB stick with the slides on it?
Yes. That's a good answer.
May I copy them?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. We're going to stick them on here and hook this up to that projector and see if that works.
Do you have Adobe Reader or Acrobat on here? It's a PDF.
So. I believe I have Adobe Reader and may have some other
If not, there are two Macs in a bag right there.
Okay, that might be even better. Yeah, if someone can bring up a... Oh, good. Oh, good. Even better. Yeah, boot that thing up. Sure.
Yeah. Okay. Right. I've only got 5,000.
Usually comes up looking like a bit like this.
Yes, it does, in fact. This would probably be a July 20th RBS slide.
Yes, yeah. Is that the PDF? Because
yes,
it's also
it
a keynote.
I see.
Yeah. There you go.
So it's like the PDF.
He's getting the dongle.
Very nice. Oh, you probably know how to do this better than I do.
Oh, no.
We lost it.
Yeah, we lost it. Let's try that.
I'm going to take that out now. Eject this.
I leave it in, actually.
Oh, okay. So you didn't copy it. Yeah.
Oh, we still trying to run
this? Oh, I tried to open it off of here.
Yes.
So are we still trying to run it off of the projector, main projector? Is that what's happening right now?
No. We're trying to run it off of the little one.
Okay.
Just getting ready to...
So then the question is...
Oh, you're just taking the file off.
I took it off here.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, that was...
I think you can yank that out. Okay. Now,
so
let's just go
for that.
Full screen. Go ahead and see.
Got a full screen.
There we go.
Very nice.
There we go.
Okay,
now
all we need to see it somewhere else.
I have to just connect now. I connected it here. Okay.
So I'll give you that.
Yes.
Yeah, some good.
So you probably want to take that cable and plug that into here. Yeah.
Okay,
in fact, move the laptop over there.
Here we are, Matthew. Sorry.
So the question is,
the laptop's going to need to get closer to that, right?
All the way over there. Okay.
Yeah. So one of us can drive. You can say, next slide, please. Is that okay? You would rather drive yourself.
Let me check if we have a remote.
And what would that do?
It opens up.
You're waiting.
Nice.
So yeah, this laptop is.
We're
going to
get a remote
to be there, so set it up, I'll bring the power over in a second,
right? Oh, not necessarily.
I find that the trails are more
than Yeah.
It's they will want it to redefine you as you resist all the time.
Oh, I know. It's clipping the about two thirds of the screen only shown.
So we'll need to change the resolution. But this way you can you'll be able to go from here to have it there.
What's the button for full screen?
Propeller L.
Propeller L.
Hey!
The resolution is crap. Yeah, I'm afraid this is going to be the projector. I'm sure. Well, the buzz is it? Looks a little bit. You might be in the way of the remote.
If you would see it now.
You might not have it working. What button were you pushing with?
As I was saying, I can't bear to do my introduction again, so we'll just jump in. This is the first project for me to talk about. When I was hired by Linotype in 65, I moved to Brooklyn, and the reason was that by then photo composition had become established commercially, and the Linotype people had done most of the job of converting the hot metal Linotype library to film. So there was an opportunity to sort of step back and say, did this new technology, film, allow us to do anything that for technical reasons had been impossible in metal type? Among the very first things that occurred to Mike Parker, my boss, and me, was script types, because on the Linotype machine, a sort of formal script that was steeply slanted and where the letters joined was just completely impossible. I mean, nobody even tried it. But with the Linofilm, the new machine, the new technology, it was very doable. So even before I got to Brooklyn, when I was still in London, I did what I always do, got some typographic issue to think about. I went to some Bride Printing Library and looked up examples of the work of English writing masters looking for a source for a new formal script face, round hand script. And I found immediately Ambrose Hill's book on the English writing masters, and this illustration in particular, which is from a man called Charles Snell, taught handwriting and accountancy in London, produced a number of books. They were not printed from type, they were copper engraved books, and these were manuals. This is how you were supposed to learn to write the English roundhand, which was the sort of standard commercial mercantile hand until the introduction of the typewriter. So I found this extraordinary plate from one of Snell's books, 1714. And you see the upper part of this slide, these incredibly meticulous geometrical diagrams that he had produced for... Yeah, good, it's working. You know, suppose you had to write this with a quill pen. How the hell would you ever do that? It must have been impossible to do this. But when I looked at these, you know, me as a type designer, I thought, well, thank you. I mean, this is just perfect. I mean, it's a gift. So when I got off the plane in Brooklyn, in New York, in the fall of 65, I had a lot of stats of Snell with me and was, you know, ready to roll with what became called Snell Roundhand in honor of Snell. So there's yet another enlargement. Imagine trying to wield your quill pen in such a way as to do that. Absolutely impossible. So there's an enlargement of Snell, and here is Snell Roundhand. I've drawn in these vertical bars here to indicate the counting width of the characters. You know, here's an F and here's an F. In the linotype machine, the F could not have gone beyond these borders because it was a piece of brass. But in film, as you can see, the F swings way out beyond its counting body into the space before it and behind it. It curves in both directions, in other words. So this design, Snell Roundhand, was really a sort of celebration of an emancipation from the constraints of metal type. And it was, as you can imagine, great fun to work on at the time. This perhaps explains that extraordinary geometrical diagram. As I said, Snell taught accountancy. These guys taught handwriting and mathematics. So the full title of one of his books was, you know, Mathematically Demonstrating How Better Alphabets, he said, may be performed. As I say, it was asking a lot of a scribe. But for me, it was just a gift. This is a few years later, I did two Boulderweights of Snell. The bold and the black. And this is a preliminary drawing, a sketch for those. Although actually it is not. It is a complete lie. As those of you who are curators and librarians know, there are almost no genuine preliminary drawings for typefaces. What happens is you design a typeface and you never make idiotic drawings like this at all. They're useless. But then somebody says in the marketing department, says, you know, I'll promote this typeface. Where are your preliminary drawings? Or some nice person says, I want to review this in a magazine. Where are your preliminary drawings? So you then have to make the preliminary drawings after you make them. So these are post-preliminary drawings. And as I say, I hope there's no one here who thinks they own any preliminary drawings to typefaces, because I'm here to tell you they're probably not what you think they are. They're post-rationalization. Yeah, you don't really need to see that. It's just the alphabet. 1966, it came out. Yes, this you do need to see. This is a favourite thing of mine. It's framed on my wall at home. This is one of the drawings from Snell, finished in August of 66. I guess the letter is about 5 inches high. And it's drawn on scratchboard, which is what we did in those days. And evidently, luckily after the font was made, some klutz in the factory got red opaquing fluid over this drawing. And they sent it back to me to fix up. No doubt I meant to do so. Meanwhile, I, you know, tossed it in a drawer or something or other and forgot about it and only found it a couple of years ago. Meanwhile, in sometime, I don't know when, early 80s, Linotype gave up supporting their photo machines because everything had gone digital. And the entire department went into the dumpster, including all of my drawings, not just for Snell, but for several other typefaces. So this is not only the single surviving drawing from Snell Roundhand, it's the single surviving drawing from a whole rather productive period of my life. And again, those of you who are concerned with preserving this stuff will understand me when I say that the only reason any typographic material has survived is because somebody forgot to throw it away. I mean, nobody deliberately preserved anything in our business at all. They did so because they were too lazy to scrap it. So Snell Roundhand was a historical revival, as you see, but not of a typeface. Snell never designed a typeface. He just produced these exquisite, as did many other writing masters of the period, these exquisite writing, handwriting manuals. But the next project I'll talk about really did have, it really was a revival of a of a typeface, or at least a bunch of typefaces. These are the three largest sizes of type from the Caslon foundry, dating, I guess, from the 1730s. The capitals, all three sizes of the capitals, are known to have been made in the foundry. Of the lowercases, the smallest one, cloudy scene down the bottom, was actually cut by Joseph Moxon in the previous century and adopted by the Caslons. Where the other two lowercases came from, we do not know. I mean, it's been suggested they too were borrowed. If so, we don't know from whom. But as you can see, look at the word members up there, the M, the lowercase M. It's kind of strange. It's too big and it's too heavy. It's a very, you know, these large sizes are spirited, but they are very eccentric. Particularly the largest of them. In the 1880s, these three faces were recut. Ownership of the Caslon foundry had passed from the family to a man whose real name was Thomas Smith, but he changed it to Caslon, enterprisingly. And he did a good job, I think, in as he recut these faces, in not over-regularizing the originals. And when I came to do a big Caslon, I actually based it more on the recutting, more on the 19th century recutting that you're looking here, than the 18th century source. I think if I had gone back to the true 18th century source, the previous slide, in the search for total authenticity, I think I would have made a typeface of very limited usefulness, the sort of ye olde pastiche, faux naive. So Big Caslon, as I say, is really a revival of a revival. This is my only text slide. Accuracy is not the truth. I'm not sure that Henri Matisse was thinking of type when he said this, but this has always been a sort of mantra for me and a license for interpretation. I think the danger in type of trying to be too literal, trying to be too authentic, is that you end up with taxidermy, something which looks lifelike on the outside, but is just kind of sawdust on the inside. And type needs skeletons and guts and all those good things. So I've never been someone who has tried to match a historical typeface exactly. I think it's very difficult to do. The job of a type reviver, I think, is to sort of steer a line between crudeness on the one hand, saw in the previous slide, and blandness on the other. I mean, the pitfalls are being crude or being boring, and you have to try and find a way between. I think of historical types as being like musical scores. We have scores composed by Garamond, by Caslon, by Bodoni, everyone. We can read them and we can play them, but we can't really reproduce exactly, I think, we can't reproduce exactly the Caslon score, say, as it sounded played on the harpsichord in Mr. and Mrs. Caslon's parlour in London in the 1750s. Each Caslon reviver who comes along, I'm only one of them, performs Caslon differently in their own time and place, and I think there are qualities associated with performance that are more important than strict fidelity, which is probably unattainable anyway. Put it another way, history is in constant rewrite. George Steiner said a thing I like. He said, each performance of a symphony is also a critique of that symphony. I like that remark. The reviver nowadays has also, of course, to be a sort of amplifier, a completer, to furnish all sorts of new characters that contemporary computer typesetting requires. So Big Caslon, when I was working on it, I had to provide all kinds of things that William didn't have to bother with in his day. There's another slide, fractions and, you know, all manner of accented characters and so on down the bottom there. If you're lucky and you produce a new type, some magazine will pick it up and give it a good run for its money. Rolling Stone has done that for me more than once. This, I think, was Wallpaper Magazine redesigned itself a few years ago and picked up Big Candle. I did go slightly sort of over the top when it came to ligatures in the italic. I feel slightly apologetic for some of that, but there are people who enjoy it. This is a place of pilgrimage for me. It's in St. Luke's Churchyard in Old Street, in the City of London. And it is the Caslon family tomb. It's the memorial to William and various members of his family. When I took this photograph, as you can see, it had been badly damaged by a falling tree limb, I think, in a storm. It looked very sad, although the sort of railing had done its job because it protected the tomb itself. I was very happy to see later on James Mosley's blog, James, someone I'm sure familiar to many of you who's taken part in this program many times. He put up this photograph to show that the local authority had done an extremely good job of restoring the Caslon tomb. So Caslon's tomb has been restored and his type has been revived. This, of course, is as it should be. So my next chapter, my next project, is the one that Michael referred to. And you can see why it has some local interest in the name of this typeface, Monticello. Here's the story. In 1943, the Princeton University Press announced a massive publishing venture, the Papers of Thomas Jefferson. The first volume came out in 1950. I think they were up to 38, I think, by now. And they planned to finish in 2026, which is the 200th anniversary of the death of Jefferson. The announcement was made in the New York Times because the Sulzberger family, the owners of the Times, bankrolled this publication. This was in the days when newspapers made money. So one of the people who saw this announcement was C.H. Griffith, Chauncey Griffith, a vice president at Linotype in Brooklyn, and the man in charge of the typographic policy. And he suggested that Linotype should make a special typeface for this publication. Obviously, a job of that size, you really had to set it by machine. You couldn't hand set all these volumes. So it pretty much had to be a Linotype face. And Griffith suggested, and the idea was accepted by Princeton, that he should make a Linotype version of an existing face called Oxford. Now, Oxford originated with the foundry that Michael mentioned, Binney and Rollinson, two Scotsmen. They started here in 1796, I think. They were not the first type founders in this country, but they were the first who didn't immediately go out of business. In fact, they did very well in the end. When Arch Binney retired, I can't remember the exact date, sold his share in the business and bought a spread in Maryland of 5,000 acres, which is the same acreage, I notice, as Monticello. So he did extremely well. Very few people in the history of type founding have made anything approaching a fortune, as you may know. The only reason we know anything about Gutenberg is from the records of the bankruptcy court. And same is true of some other of my predecessors. But anyway, one of the faces that Binney and Ronaldson produced survived in three different sizes and showed up very much later at American Type Founders, ATF. ATF was a consortium of American type founders who came together in the 1890s because they were no longer viable as competitors, so they pulled their resources and made one big conglomerate. And ATF produced this face, as I say, in three sizes, called Oxford, and it was quite successful. It was used by some very distinguished American book designers, and Bruce Rogers, and most notably by Daniel Berkeley Updike, who set his magisterial printing types, their history, form, and uses in the Oxford type, a book that obviously is the sort of Bible for people like myself. So, you know, I'm very familiar with that face and liked it very much. So the project for Griffith was to render Oxford a foundry type, a handset type, as a liner typeface. And notice in that slide, you see how both the italic and the Roman alphabets are the same length, capital and lowercase. This is, there is some price for the convenience of the linotype system, for the economies of machine composition. And one of them is what was called duplexing, which is forcing the italic to be on the same width as the Roman. I'll show you an example of that in a minute. This is a linotype drawing, about 17 by 14. You can just guess the scale from the pencil there. Wrong reading, pencil outline. It looks like an engineering blueprint, and that is just exactly what it is. Michael last night was warning us all to wash our hands before we handle the treasures in the Rare Book School. You will see, I think, on that drawing, the beauty of what happens when you don't wash your hands. There is a wonderful patina on those sheets of paper from constant use. And no one in the linotype factory had clean hands, I can assure you. I mean, you should do what Michael says, but to me, I have a different background from you, Ferrick. I started work in a type foundry and then went to work in a factory. And if your hands are clean in type foundry, you're goofing off, you know. I came up with dirty hands, and there's a lot of sweat and tears in that nice piece of paper. Every one of these folios of drawings had a sheet in the bottom, and you can see the history of this. They started in 1944. Mr. Griffith provided proofs of Oxford, and the projectoscope was a massive enlarger. It occupied a whole room where you could go from the actual type size to the drawing size, which I showed you in the previous slide. Masses of information on those sheets. This is a hard slide to see, but you're actually looking at a linotype matrix. And you see that there are two letters stamped into the face of it. They happen to be FL ligatures. And you see what I mean by them having to be the same width, Roman and Italic. They're on the same piece of brass. They can't be anything different. The reason for that was that it was very convenient for a linotype operator to shift from Roman to Italic. If you had to change to another face or another size, you had to change the magazine on the linotype machine, and that was a pain in the neck to have to do that. But this was very, very simple operation. Here is the drawing of the original linotype F in the italic of Monticello. And it's a very odd and deformed-looking thing, necessarily. Because, as I was saying about Snell, there's no way this F could sort of go outside the brass body. In time, of course, with photocomposition and with digital type, it was possible to go back and revise, these forms that were distorted in the interest of linotype composition. Here's a much more elegant-looking and a much more faithful-looking F. That would have come along many years later when, as I say, the technology changed and those linotype constraints became completely irrelevant, obsolete. Much nicer letter, curving forwards and backwards. So everything was fine at the Princeton University Press as long as they continued to set these Jefferson volumes on the linotype machine. But then I think they changed to a digital machine, Linotronic or something, and then they wanted to go, being a forward-thinking enterprise, to PostScript fonts. And Linotype had not made PostScript fonts in Monticello, so they got some outfit to convert their digital data into PostScript, and this was the result. This is not a good letter, I'm here to tell you. It's made up entirely of straight-line segments. There's various other things wrong with it if you look through the whole font. So Princeton University Press and the person of Chuck Creasy came to me and asked me if I could do better than this. And I was so arrogant as to say I thought I could. But it was not a simple job. What I had to do was to make a postscript outline description of Monticello and try to make it look as close as possible to the original metal Monticello that Griffith had produced. And this is not an easy job, I may say. The danger is that, well, you know, if you print from metal, relief letterpress, the impression is more than a kiss. There is a squeeze in addition to a kiss. The ink spreads a little bit. If you print a digital image by offset lithography, there is only a kiss. There is no squeeze. In the old country, they used to say, what is it? A kiss without the squeeze is like apple pie without the cheese or something or other. So I had to kind of put the cheese or the squeeze back into this typeface. And it was hard to do. But let me first show you an enlargement of Binney's design. It is a very odd typeface when you look at it closely. Griffith, when Monticello was released, wrote the following. The principal key to the matter is the lively variety in serif shapes and their bracketing to the stems. Quite unlike the technique of contemporary designers who follow a uniform pattern of serif and fillet, Binney goes almost to the other extreme in disregard of such uniformity. The overall effect is recognized by many as an artistic achievement that has not been excelled by any type cutter before or since Binney's time. The variant serif motif was achieved through a premeditated and well-executed plan of design. Well, I'm not so sure. I mean, if you look at the top left-hand corner of the letters in the upper line, extraordinary variety in the forms there. Now, Griffith said this was deliberate and premeditated. Maybe not. Maybe this was a guy in a hurry who was perhaps not the most skillful punch cutter who's ever lived. But either way, I don't mean to dump on Binney. The fact of the matter is that, you know, whether this was achieved deliberately or by sort of nonchalance in the production, it is a very agreeable, pleasant typeface to read. And my hat is off to the people at Linotype because I think they did capture this sort of variability within Binney's design, and the different sizes, mind you, quite well. And it's the result is a very, very likeable typeface, eccentric as it is. So when I came to do this job of adding weight, I found that I could not just add it uniformly all around the sort of bare metal outline by sort of dipping it in chocolate. That looked terrible. I found I had to add weight very selectively. And this is a diagram that shows the sort of raw metal, linotype drawing, if you like, and what I produced, trying to get this type to look better in its digital form. And as you see, I did add weight, but I added much more weight on the horizontal strips, the surface and so on. There is weight there. And if you look up there, I bit the crotch in deeper too, because I didn't want to lose definition. As I say, the dipped in chocolate look is really very unpleasant in type. So, you know, I this whole project that Princeton gave me, there was a very modest budget to, speaking of type fans, didn't make big fortunes, but I was very interested in it because I had to do a lot of trial setting to try and get this right. And I don't flatter myself that the recent volumes of the Jefferson papers are as good typographically as the very first ones. But I do think, if I may say so, I shouldn't, that they are improvement on the sort of intermediate state that that they came to me to complain of. Jefferson loved fractions, sprinkled with fractions everywhere. So I had to make a special sort of fraction font. And you know, it's not very hard to do fractions when the numerators and denominators are the same. When you've got two and three, it's a little trickier, I can tell you. It took some time to work that out. One other thing, that's good, it's the TA combination is current. You wouldn't have found that in Linotype or in Oxford in the Microtype, but I thought it was worth doing in the postscript version. There were also lots of lovely things that Jefferson scribbled as he wrote his papers and his correspondence. You see some of them there. The act used in it, pre-email address, meaning of commercial act, pound, LB. This, of course, is per. This lovely squiggly P is per. There's a leave. Yes, you see this? LT leave pronoun. This was an obsolete French currency. I didn't think there were coins any longer, even in the early 19th century. But it was still used for accounting purposes. CWT is 100 grade, of course. So, again, I had to shoehorn a bunch of non-standard characters into this font that was actually quite amusing to do. This is... I don't know how well you can see this sign. You know, in very early typefaces, the ampersand was treated as a lowercase letter. Over time, it sort of grew into a capital letter. Nowadays, I suppose that makes sense because it's used in, names of businesses and so on, where it really does have to sort of sort with the capitals. So the ampersand in Monticello is faithful reproduction of Binney's. But, of course, it was used constantly by Jefferson, who never wrote the word and out, A-N-D. And when you see it in with the lowercase, it has a very spotty effect. And, after, it looks too heavy, too big to me. So sort of after the fact, I rather regretted that I hadn't made a smaller and neater ampersand. Too late now, but you learn these things, when you come to look at the, you get the feedback, as it were. Other things occur to you. So that if I had to do this again, I would have made a lowercase ampersand for this particular typeface, something you don't meet every day. So my last project to talk about. Continuing our tour of the Ivy League. This is Yale. I don't have any kind of college degree at all, so it was great fun for me, but I taught at Yale in the graphic design school for, 30-something years. And a few years ago, the present printer to the university, John Gamble, who I met originally when he was a student, asked me to design a typeface for Yale, not for the press, not for the university press, but for the university at large, for the admin people, for faculty, students, anyone bona fide member of the academic community at Yale can download this typeface and use it. So John asked me to do two versions of it, one for printing and for the web, and then another one, a different version, for signs on campus. I don't know this university well enough to know whether any of your buildings have their names on them. But God forbid you should have to find a building at Yale. You have to ask on every corner. None of them have their names on them. But they've changed that. I mean, they've now got some signs. And of these two versions, the print and what we call street, the sign for the signs, campus signs, the latter was the more urgent because they've already started thinking about these signs. So that was the one I kind of had to work on first. And they'd already decided that the signs would be principally in capital letters. Now, this may sound strange, but this was an odd priority for me because I think type designers of the Latin alphabet think of capitals principally as being initials for words otherwise in lowercase. Obviously, you can use them for words all in caps. The Romans invented them for words all in caps, and they look very fine. But, that's sort of subsidiary use of them. But for signs, not so. So I got to thinking about this whole, we say the Latin alphabet. We have two alphabets. There's a big one and a small one. Some of the letters are the same, some are kind of similar, some have nothing whatever to do with one another. And getting some sort of sympathy between these two alphabets in the same typeface is an absolutely enduring problem. I mean, every type designer goes through this every time we try and design a Latin typeface. Getting these two things into some sort of synthesis is very hard. And the earliest Roman faces from the Incunabula period were, in my opinion, you know, seldom successful at doing that. The caps stand out like a sore thumb. The first typeface, in my view, to achieve this was produced for Aldus Manutius in 1495 in Venice. This is an example of it. And the secret of this, I think, by the way, just because I was talking about this, you see how the ampersand in the fourth line down is smaller than the capital? This was back in the days when the ampersand was really treated still as necessarily being used with the lowercase. A very good example of what I was blaming myself for just now. Anyway, this typeface appeared in a small, very undistinguished-looking book called De Etna, about Etna. It was the work of Pietro Bembo. He wrote it when he was still a student. He was learning Greek in Sicily. His father, who was a Venetian diplomat, came to visit him, and they walked up Etna. And young Pietro wrote a little essay about their expedition. It's a very inconsequential piece of literature. I don't think the volcanologists have ever paid it much attention, but it was printed by Aldus as, in my view, we don't actually know why, but in my view, it was as a trial of this typeface. And within this little book, there are several versions, alternative versions of some of the lowercase letters. So it's really Aldus and his punch cutter, Francesco Grifo from Bologna, inventing Latin type, really, and trying out different forms. And I think what Aldus had in mind was to give this little book, you know, it's small, it's about 5 inches by 3, to his friends, you know, in his artistic and literary circle in the Veneto, and say, hey, do you like this E with the horizontal bar, or do you like this E with the oblique bar? What do you think, you know? Probably the idea that they would then remove the less popular forms and sort of standardize on it, but they never did. I mean, they printed some other books in this, and all of these alternative characters are still in there in a kind of fascinating way. So why, you know, thinking about this whole mess of synthesizing caps and lowercase, I thought about De Etna, and in the Beinecke Library at Yale, they have a copy of De Etna, not a book you see every day. So I was able to go and pore over this little book and examine the letter forms. You know, to me, this is the archetype of type. I mean, every Latin type that has every Roman type we have followed this, and is really a development of this of this design. So it was great to have in front of me the original of this at Yale. So I produced a typeface. And in addition to this kind of, I mean, there are probably only 3 people in all of Yale that know there is a copy of De Etna in Beinecke. Me and John and someone else, I mean, I don't know. But there was another reason to like this Aldine model for Yale. One of the typefaces they had used in the past was monotype Bembo, which was also derived from that very same book, De Etna. The digital version of Bembo is too light, to my way of thinking, so one of the things we did with the Yale face was to beef it up a bit. But you can probably see there's some sort of family resemblance between those two two typefaces. So there's a little bit of a sort of rather tenuous precedent of using an Aldine design for Yale. As I said, almost no buildings at Yale have their names on them. The prevailing architectural style at Yale is Gothic Revival, is it ever? And the few buildings that have their names on them have them in Gothic capitals like this. I mean, it's beautiful. The capitals are lovely. It's been damaged. In order to take this photograph, I had to have someone come pull the bushes back so I could actually see this thing, you know? They're totally obscure. Somebody told me that Frank Lloyd Wright, when he went to Yale, insisted on staying in a room in the Harkness Tower. The Harkness Tower is this colossal Gothic tower right in the middle of the campus, because it was the only place from which he could not see the Harkness Tower. That gives you a sense of the architectural style. Yeah. So here's the new face in action. New signs on the campus at Yale to help us find our way around. And you see, they're principally in capitals. The lowercase has a sort of subsidiary role. The opposite priority of them is instinctual to people like me. It seemed to me that since the Roman capitals began as inscriptional forms, signs are very much like inscriptions. I mean, you stick them on the wall, or they're freestanding on a signboard or something. Really, they are like tombstones or memorial plaques, lettered, as I say, mostly in capitals. This is a comparison of the two versions that I mentioned of this face. And if I hadn't kind of spoiled the story by telling you this ahead of time, and I showed you this slide, those of you who are typographically astute would, I'm sure, think that this was indeed the print version, sort of normally proportioned version of this typeface. And this one, looking up the top, you would say, oh, that's very much obviously for small sizes. This is for footnotes. Because the letters are a little bit heavier, the contrast, thick to thin, is different, the lowercase xite is greater, there's more space between the letters. All of these are symptoms of a typeface intended for use at tiny sizes. Well, you would actually be wrong, but you'd be very intelligent, because there is an odd paradoxical similarity between type for very small sizes and type for very big sizes on signs. The reason is this, of course, that neither of them are read in ideal circumstances, ideal environments. You never see a sign for the first time in front of your face. You see it in the distance, you see it coming around the corner, you see it at night, you see it from the windows of a bus, you see it driving past at 70 miles an hour. You never see a sign initially in an ideal situation. So these compensatory things are done, just as they are done for tiny type, to make signs more readable at first glance, as it were. So yeah, here we are outside the Beinecke Library with a new sign, and the eager students lining up to look at De Etna inside. Well, God bless Yale, from having no signs on the campus at all, this typeface has now gone viral. You can't get away from it. Here is a no parking sign. Or reserved parking, I'm sorry. This is cast in bronze, if you please. I've never had a typeface cast in bronze before. I'm so proud. So anyway, I took this photograph, the Yale University Security, because the T is falling off the word security. It's an insecure T. I informed the authorities, who had no idea what I was talking about. Well, it's very nice when you've designed a typeface, and as I was saying earlier, some nice magazine or someone picks it up, or it shows up in a handsome book. But my little epiphany, I think, for the L typeface happened when I was wandering down Chapel Street one day. And I saw this. You feel that when your typeface is on the trash barrels, it kind of has arrived, It's been assimilated into the culture of the place. and more so particularly perhaps this. I mean, a recycling bin. There seems to be a very nice symmetry here, you know. We recycle our cans and bottles. We recycle our type. We make a difference, as the slogan says. We shouldn't just trash a typeface because it's whatever it is, 515 years old. We should revive it, revitalize it. There are centuries of good use left in it yet. Well, I've got this far in this talk without saying Otsov on the shoulders of giants. The point of that analogy, which has become a sort of cliche among type revivers, to express our debt to our hugely illustrious forebears, actually implies more than that. It's a sort of metaphor. It means that however gigantic the giant on whose shoulders you are perched, and however puny your own stature, still the sum of your combined heights puts you at an elevation from which you can see further than the giant can. This is simple trigonometry. That further may only be a step or two, but for me, we tiny sedulous apes have a responsibility to use that little fraction of elevation, that advantage, as we stand on the shoulders of giants. And that advantage nowadays, I think, is mostly a technical one. Well, I'm not sure that this is the best illustration of the advances in typography in the last 500 years. And it's hard to know what Pietro Bembo would have made of all of this. Here he is as a very eminent cardinal in old age. Or more pertinently, what Aldus and Grifo, his type founder, would have thought. Of course, I don't know the answer, but fatuous as it may sound, I do sort of worry about that. I feel ghosts looking over my shoulder. It's a very private hang-up. As I say, you know, you can admire De Etna all by yourself in the Beinecke and no one else knows it's there. If you design a typeface of entirely your own concoction, if that's even possible, there's no one else's reputation is harmed if you screw up. But when you borrow something, however remotely, I think you take on some obligations of stewardship, some accountability. Accountability to whom? To ghosts? Well, not exactly. Accountability to a tradition of trying to advance the state of the art, to innovate to the degree that it's possible. I'll end with a quote. Tradition is not a matter for traditionalists. They produce traditionalism, which is of no use. Tradition is produced by true innovators who keep it alive. That was said by Franz Zeyer in a little book that I recommend called Rightness and Likeness. He's a Swiss bookbinder. And I think that's something to aspire to, but reviving should be more than mere resuscitation. You know, it means adding something new to the old. So what I try to do myself and what I advocate is, you know, you should acknowledge your debt and try and contribute something of your own. So thank you.
If there is some generosity and some truth in the world that could save him, is there some epiphany by which he could know the beauty that obtains in the human world? And I think this evening, Matthew Carter has given us a glimpse into not only beautiful typefaces, but, if I may say so without embarrassing him, a lovely mind. It is the case that we have time for a few questions, and I think that Matthew will moderate his own question.
Sure, absolutely. If anyone's still awake. Yes.
My question is about numbers. When you're designing a typeface, as you said, for printing, say, memos versus buildings, I noticed that the addresses were in lowercase and that the numbers matched. What is the decision-making process behind that?
It's involved, you know. Originally, all numbers are what are generally known nowadays as old style. I mean, they were considered like lowercase characters. More recently, well, I would say probably in the 18-teens, type founders began including two sets of figures in their typefaces, the ones you described, the old-style ones, and then a set of figures that were all the same height, sometimes the same height as the capitals, sometimes a bit smaller, but anyway, of uniform height, a set of figures of uniform height. And over time, these became the standard. Most typefaces, you know, when I first was involved at Linotype and so on, all the Linotype faces, as far as I know, had these so-called modern figures, lining figures. Since then, people have gone back to a certain extent to the two set of figure models. And which you use where is entirely up to you. I mean, a bit in the same way that I was complaining how the Monticello ampersand stands out in lowercase composition. If you use big figures in certain texts, you know, Michael mentioned Sports Illustrated, whom I did some work some years ago. Sports Illustrated, the text is full of numbers, you know, stats and weights and heights and scores and everything. And if you use big numbers, the page gets terribly spotty and unsightly. So I designed some sort of hybrid numbers for that particular typeface. And, you know, for the addresses and the Yale signs that are set in lowercase, I think it would be natural to use the old style figures. If you needed, occasionally figures do come in the capital part of the sign. For that, I'm sure they would use cap high figures, the lining thing, which I did for the typeface. I mean, I made both sets. Yeah. I think we can go to dinner. Yes, someone at the back.
When you're lining an old type, and you're creating a new character,
yes,
isn't in the original. How do you convert from the old to the new?
It's a good question. I think what happens is, I can't speak for anyone else, but for me, I sort of marinate myself in the original, you know, and in the course of redrawing all the letters that do exist, working on them, I think by some sort of osmosis, you acquire a feeling for the workmanship of whoever it was that you are reviving. And I think by the time you've done that, when it comes to doing, you know, a dollar sign or something which wasn't in Catalan's type, for example, you probably have a sort of a sense of channeling how he would have done it, if you see what I mean. This doesn't sound very scientific, and it's not, but that's the best way I can describe the process. You just have to, marinate yourself in the work and try and understand the how the person thought about their work. You know, it's not foolproof, but it's how I do. It's not easy, always. Yeah. Yes?
Seems like you have successfully bridged the worlds of the academic and the practical as a person who has spent his life working in type foundries and working with the commercial institutions and corporations which were involved in creating typefaces and selling them to those people who were selling their hands with the object of making money.
Yes.
I just wondered if you could comment on those two different worlds.
The academic and the... Yes. You know, in some ways, happy as I am to be here, believe me, I've loved this visit. I feel like a bit of an interloper in a way because, you know, but my background... I think of myself as an industrial designer, frankly. And much of my work, some of it Michael mentioned in his introduction, has been concerned with things like phone books and body type for newspapers, legibility of type on screens and so on. Very humdrum stuff. Not the sort of thing that attracts people who are interested in the world of fine printing or rare books or fine bindings and so on. The academic world, you know, I mentioned my debt, I should have mentioned it more, to the St. Bride Printing Library in London, which I have used all my life, really. And James Mosley, who I mentioned has often been here, is a sort of lifelong friend. And I have benefited enormously from his scholarship and from the scholarship of other academics and so on. My attitude to academic history is really predatory. You know, I look at it for things I can use. I'm not a scholar. I'm not a historian, as you've gathered from my talk. But I admire those people, and you know, many typographic scholars, bibliographers, and so on are my friends. How much we have in common is always a thing that we can argue about. But I, you know, my as I was saying, I come from the sort of dirty hands side of this, rather than the well-washed hands that you all have. Not that there's a moral judgment in that. Just how things played out, you know. But yeah, it's a good question you asked me, and I'm very conscious of my debt to the academic world and its resources. Yeah. Yes.
In this matter of having to add the squeeze to a digital type when moving from metal, you articulated a challenge that you face that lay people probably wouldn't have guessed existed. I'm curious if you have any thoughts as to the future and the emergence of whatever the next digital typographically related technology might be, and what other challenges we might face.
I once asked a question like this to a guy from IBM. He said, "No next questions." So, this is a next question, I can see. It's almost a next big thing question. But, I don't really know. I mean, you know, everyone now is excited about web fonts. I got involved in this a long time, well, mid-90s, working for Microsoft. And there's been a strange period. You know, I'm very unpopular with web designers because I did Verdana and Georgia, and those are two of a very small number of typefaces that really do work on the screen. And web designers have got sick of me because, you know, they want many more typefaces that will work on the screen. And so they're, oh, God, not Verdana again. So, but we're just on the sort of tipping point where there is a new business model, a new technical model, to get far more typefaces onto the web type. Different people have different approaches to it, but all of us are kind of concerned with this at the moment. And, you know, quite honestly, how this works out in terms of quality standards and so on, I think it's really too early to say. You know, when I was approached by Microsoft in about 93, with the idea of doing what became Verdana and Georgia, I said, this is a big mistake, a big philosophical mistake. You must not design a typeface for any particular technology. It will be a self-obsoleting typeface because the technology advances, leaves your design behind. This had happened to me with the coming of photocomposition. It happened to me with the coming of digital type. I designed special typefaces to mitigate the problems of those technologies in their early stages. So what happened? The engineers fixed everything. My typefaces were thrown out. They all went back to Helvetica and Times. Quite right, too. But, you know, the Microsoft people said, well, we've got news for you. We're going to be stuck with this present computer screen resolution for quite a while. And they were right. I mean, 15 years have gone by. Screen resolutions have improved a little bit. Photometric resolutions have improved a whole lot. Anti-aliasing and clear type and all these things have improved type on screen a great deal, in my opinion. Where all of this is going, I mean, I really don't know. I mean, I'm old enough that I've heard people prognosticate in the early days of phototype. You know, I remember very vividly a talk by someone who said, you know, when we abandon metal, it will no longer be necessary to set type in straight horizontal lines. It's no longer little rectangular section pieces of metal. Type will all be wavy and go round in circles and so on. And for about a month it did, you know, but then then it dawned on people that type didn't go in straight horizontal lines because it was little bits of rectangular section metal. Type was made as little bits of rectangular section metal because type went in straight horizontal lines. So these prognostications usually are calamitous, you know. So I've tried to discipline myself not to make them because I've lived through too many that failed. So I really don't know. I mean, it's a very good question, and someone like me should have a responsible answer to it, but I don't really have it. Partly because things are moving rather fast at the moment after this long sort of stagnant period from the mid-90s, where web fonts are concerned. Whereas I say, everyone's been cursing me. Things are now sort of floodgate has opened, and there's all kinds of different models for doing this. Where it will all end up, your guess is good.
We'd like to thank you very much indeed and give you a poster for your talk, which is adorned with your own typefaces. Where we will have a reception in Matthew Carter's honor. Please join us there.